BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the virtual space where the top experts get to explain to you and me one of the big issues of the day. Inside this week's 28 minutes, millions of UK citizens live in the EU and millions of EU citizens live in the UK. Now that freedom of movement has ended, what's happening to all those people? Back in 2016, a major Brexit promise was that the UK would take back control of its borders and immigration. That meant ending the European Union's policy of freedom of movement. But that left the question of what would happen to the millions of British people who live in EU countries and the millions of EU citizens who live here. The UK government drew up something called the EU Settlement Scheme, and the deadline for European Union citizens living here to sign up to it has just passed. So, what is it, and is it working? Step into the briefing room and let's find out. First, let's settle some facts about settlement. Joining me in the briefing room is the BBC's home editor, Mark Easton. Mark Easton, why do we have an EU settlement scheme?
Well, of course, after Brexit, a decision needed to be made about what to do with the millions of EU and indeed European Economic Area, EEA citizens and those from Switzerland who were living in the UK. The end of free movement and their right to live in Britain came to an end with the end of the Brexit transition on December the 31st last year. Now, the government was aware of this issue and needed to put something in place. And a couple of years ago, they introduced the European Union Settled Status Scheme. And what that does essentially is say that if you were resident in the UK before that date of December the 31st, the end of the Brexit transition, then you can apply for settled status, which would give you indefinite leave to remain. And indeed, that scheme, the ministers would say, has been a huge success. The latest figures suggest something like 5.3 million European citizens have applied for settled status, which was a bit of a surprise at the Home Office because their estimates were that it was going to be between 3.5 and 4.1 million. So in that sense, it's actually exceeded expectations. And those people who are granted settled status, once they're in the system, as it were, once they've applied, they're basically protected, and already something like 5.2 million Europeans have been given settled status, and there are an estimated 400,000 in the system, and they will continue to have their rights protected while they're awaiting the outcome of that decision. There's one little sort of caveat, which is that you need to have been resident in the UK for 5 years. Now, of course, some people may have been here for, you know, 4.5 years or even 4.5 days. And so there is a thing called pre-settled status. And what that means is that you are allowed to stay. You don't have indefinite leave to remain. You have a sort of limited leave to remain. It means you can't claim welfare. But once your 5 years are up, you are then given settled status and you will then have indefinite leave to remain.
Do they move automatically to settled status or do they have to make an application later on?
No, they would actually have to make an application.
So settled status means that you can actually continue to get the kind of benefits which applied to you before. Pre-settled status means that you can stay here for a bit until you gradually get to the status of being settled.
Exactly. And I think what's interesting about the scheme itself is that it's actually more generous than under the freedom of movement rules, because under this scheme, settled status, any EU national who's been here for 5 years can settle. But under freedom of movement rules, actually, EU nationals had to demonstrate a history of work and otherwise self-sufficiency to claim residency. So in that sense, it is a more generous scheme than we had before. And I think that's been quite an interesting and perhaps to some quite surprising thing. I think there were some concerns that post-Brexit, actually, there would be quite a hostile attitude towards EU citizens living here. But in fact, it's been quite the reverse. And all the rhetoric, political rhetoric around this has been about our friends and wanting to do the very best for the EU citizens who do reside here.
What happens if people don't apply?
Well, here's the difficulty. So June the 30th, of course, was the deadline, 6 months after the end of transition, for people to apply to get settled status or indeed to register for pre-settled status. Once that deadline was over, any EU citizen who was still here and had not applied or had not received settled status was effectively unlawfully resident here, and that they would no longer be able to work, use the NHS, rent a house, open a bank account. Potentially they face deportation.
Mark, when you say that people have to show that they've been here for a period of time, how do you prove that?
You have to have been continuously resident. So you can't have been out of the country for more than 6 months during that 5 years. So there are quite tight controls. There are obviously, you know, ways of demonstrating if you've been in work or you've been renting a house, or if you're a child, you've been at school and so on. But all EU citizens who are applying for settled status have had and will have to demonstrate, give some proof that they have been continuously resident in the UK for some time.
Mark, is this to be regarded, getting settled status, as a route to citizenship?
Yes, I think the expectation is that many of those who are given indefinite leave to remain will decide to become British citizens, but it's not essential. Obviously, many foreign nationals do live in the UK quite legally and lawfully, and there's no requirement to move to citizenship. Still in this country, actually, becoming a British citizen is quite a laborious and expensive thing to do, and it may be that my expectation would be that the vast majority of those EU and EEA citizens who are resident here with settled status will probably be happy to remain as such. However, you know, there is a lot of push on ministers and indeed some enthusiasm, I think, in the Home Office and elsewhere for EU citizens to become British citizens if it can be done.
Mark Easton. OK, that's the policy here in the UK. We'll talk more about its implementation later. But before that, what about Britons who live in the EU? Next in the briefing room is Michaela Benson, Professor of Sociology at the University of Lancaster. Professor Benson, are EU or EEA, European Economic Area countries, going through the same process with regard to Brits there as we are to EU citizens over here?
The complicated thing when it comes to the different EU countries is that some of them are doing what the UK is doing, where people have to apply and be judged about whether they are eligible for the new residence permits. But then there are other countries where people are able to go and exchange existing residence status for a new residence status.
I take it that the rollover system is much easier. In other words, the one that we don't have.
Yes, I think that it is more straightforward because people are not necessarily being judged for whether they meet criteria in the same way as they are in the other system.
So, roughly speaking, which of the major countries has which system?
The two countries in the EU which have the largest number of British citizens are, of course, Spain and France. And what's convenient is that they both operate different systems. So Spain has this rollover system, as you've called it, which in legal terms is called a declaratory system. So people go with their existing residence documents and those are exchanged. There's also no hard deadline in Spain for people to do that. France, which is home to somewhere in the region of 150,000 British citizens, if the official statistics are correct, has a constitutive system where people are having to go and apply for this new residence status. Their system is much more proximate to what we've seen with the EU settled status system in the UK. So people are going along, they're filling in this application form online, and then somebody somewhere centrally is deciding whether those people actually meet the terms for residence in France under the withdrawal agreement. Then they have to go to their local authority office. They have to kind of give their fingerprints and various other things before the local authority office will then issue them at some stage with a new biometric residence card.
Do they face deadlines as people do here? We had the 30th of June deadline. Do they face similar deadlines or have those deadlines already passed?
In the 13 EU member states which are operating this type of system, there are a range of different deadlines. There was a deadline yesterday. At midnight, the applications window closed for British citizens in France, Latvia and Malta. This morning, probably around 11 o'clock this morning, the French Ministry of the Interior announced that they'd extended the deadline until the end of September. So very much beyond the 11th hour, I would say. So after the deadline had officially closed. In some of the other member states that are operating that system, the deadline was always the 31st of December of this year.
How well has that application process gone?
If we take somewhere like France, for example, the system's been up and running for quite a long period of time. So it started kind of, I think, in October last year. So there's been a lot of time for that system to kind of roll through. It's the first time France have operated an electronic system for registration. So I think given all of that, it's gone quite well. The issue appears to have been in France that actually the communications campaigns were not as widespread as they needed to be.
Has any significant proportion of British residency abroad not managed to get in their claims for residency?
The latest figures that were released show that 75,000 British citizens living in those countries operating this application system have not yet applied for their residence. Now, of course, this includes countries who have a deadline at the end of the year, but as we were heading towards a deadline at midnight, it looked as though 7,400 British citizens in France had not yet registered.
Do you have any additional information on places where it might not have gone so well compared with others?
I think that, especially when we look at the other countries which had the 30th of June deadline, so Latvia and Malta, it's very clear that there's been a shortfall in applications in Malta as well. And when I was looking across the various different member states this morning, it is very evident that there is quite significant mismatch in most countries in terms of the number of applications versus the estimated volume of the population. I was contacted at the beginning of May on Twitter by a British citizen who lived in Romania. And they said to me that one of the reasons they thought that British citizens weren't applying for their residence was because of the other things that people need a residence document for. And what he said was that in order to go and get his vaccination for COVID, he needed to take a residence document with him. And so he was waiting to apply for his post-Brexit residence status until he had had his vaccination. So there may be other things that are contingent on people's residence permits, which are also holding them back from being in a situation where they don't have them. I mean, similarly, this is a case that's a bit closer to home for me. My father, who lives in France, is one of the British citizens who's found themselves without a driving license. And yet when he went to apply through the new system that's been made available, they told him that he couldn't apply for his exchanged driving license, his new French driving license, without his withdrawal residence permit, which he's been waiting on for months. So there are a whole load of different things that start to come into play that are contingent on those residence documents.
Are you expecting, as we get further into later in the year and into next year, after the next set of deadlines, a slew of stories about Brits abroad who effectively have lost the ability to make claims and to do the things that they need to do?
I think that's how we're going to see it. It will start with a slow trickle. I don't think that for most people who haven't applied, there will be immediate consequences. But in the months and years to come, we will start to see that. So there will be a long tail to this story of citizens' rights for British citizens who live in the EU, just as there will be for EU citizens in the UK.
Michaela Benson on the British abroad. Let's now return to the UK. We know that EU citizens living here had to apply for the settlement scheme by the 30th of June. So to what extent has that happened? Catherine Barnard is Professor of European Union and Labour Law at Cambridge University. Catherine Barnard, let's start with the numbers. Do we have any good idea how many people may not have met the deadline?
No, actually we don't, which might seem rather odd to your listeners. But the fact is that the UK never had a good idea how many EU nationals were actually working in the UK or living in the UK prior to the 31st of December 2020. And so although there were figures bandied around of about 3.4 million, the reality is we just don't know. What we do know is that 5.6 million people had applied by the end of May. And since then, there's been a huge influx of applications, somewhere in the region of 10,000 to 12,000 a day. So we're probably looking at about 6 million applications. And given that no government scheme has ever achieved 100% application rate, even an application failure by 1%, you're talking 60,000 people, and you can multiply it beyond that. The government has had some indication that maybe there'll be 130,000 who've not applied. Bottom line is, we just don't know.
You've just told me that we thought there were 3.4 or so million EU citizens in the UK, and we've got 6 million applications.
That's absolutely right. The figures were way out, but the fact is we just genuinely don't know how many EU nationals are here.
Catherine, when your employer asks you for your status or your landlord asks you for your status, what have you got to show them?
That's a difficult question. So there are two things. If you've got settled or pre-settled status, you can get a shareable code. It's a digital code that you can get from the website. And then you give that to your employer or your landlord. Now, that works well, assuming that your employer or your landlord is digitally literate. And one of the remarkable things that we've discovered in Great Yarmouth, where we've been doing some work, is that some of the landlords who have houses of multiple occupation are not themselves either registered or just not digitally literate. And so how they will check that digital share code is a problem. If you haven't got settled or pre-settled status, but you have applied before the 30th of June deadline, you will get a certificate of application, which is essentially email confirmation. And there, at least, you can wave that under the nose of your employer or landlord to say that you're applying. And the government has said that your rights will be protected while your case is being considered.
Now, let's talk about the 60,000 or however many it may be who fail to apply. What should we assume about the kinds of people these are likely to be?
They fall in a range of groups. First of all, they are likely to be old, possibly with dementia or some other serious illness. Also, there are a group of people who've been in the country for a very long time, maybe 30, 40 years, who see themselves as British but have never formalised that status. And they think that they can't or they shouldn't have to actually make an application. So that's one group. The second group is children, particularly children in care. We know that there is a good third of children in care who are of EU origin who probably have not been registered. There's a lot of families who have still not realised that even though the parents have got settled or pre-settled status, they need to apply for that for their children. Indeed, in Ipswich last week, a local school spotted this as a problem and got one of the charities in to help parents make applications for their children. And in just one visit, this charity registered 40 children. So it gives you an idea that there's going to be a problem there. The next group are those who are low skilled and probably low paid. Now, they may not have access to the technology. Remember, you need a smartphone to make the application. They might not have email addresses. And then there's another group, which are non-EU national family members. So by that, I mean, if I am Polish, working in the UK, and I'm married to a Brazilian husband, not only must I apply for a settled or pre-settled status, but so must my Brazilian spouse. Now, of course, the programme's called EU Settlement Scheme, and so lots of people don't realise that their non-EU spouse needs to apply as well.
What can you tell us about government efforts to try and reach these groups and get them to apply?
To be fair, the government has tried. There has been an extensive publicity campaign. It's also funded quite a lot of local groups, community groups, to help them reach out to people in their area who need to register. It also has had a resolution centre. And in the past, that resolution centre has been very effective in trying to help people resolve their problems. But of course, in the last month or so, it's been absolutely swamped, so people haven't been able to get online. So the government has tried. But of course, if you are working in a rural farm in Cornwall and you don't leave your caravan that you've been living in for months on end, you might just not have seen all of this publicity.
If, for one reason or another, we don't actually manage to reach the hard-to-reach groups, at what point do we begin to realise we have a problem?
Most immediately is when they are looking for a new job and their employer must ask about their immigration status, and they say, I don't know what you're talking about. Likewise, when they're looking for flats, and then no doubt they will start to panic. And of course, there is a problem now because the deadline for applying formally expired on the 30th of June. Now, the government has said that if you've got reasonable grounds for not applying in time, and the government has committed to being sympathetic to late applications. But as time goes by, the government has said it will become less sympathetic. So people really need to apply, even if they've missed the deadline. And then the government has also said that there is some sort of 28-day period where people can still apply, particularly if they've been picked up by some form of immigration enforcement. They will be encouraged to apply in this quasi-grace period.
Catherine Barnard on some of the potential human consequences of the settlement process, which will, in many instances, depend on how policy is implemented. And that depends in turn on political calculation. Jill Rutter is a former senior civil servant and senior fellow at the Institute for Government and joins me now in the briefing room. Jill Rutter, if you could take the step of just imagining for a moment that I'm the Home Secretary, you're giving me advice. As I look at this situation, do I have a potential problem?
Yes, you have a very big potential problem. So the problem for you as Home Secretary is you presided over a scheme not designed by you, but a scheme that has been massively successful in terms of huge numbers of people registered, but potentially large numbers of hard cases about to hit you. First, the people who fail to apply by the deadline, and you've said that you will allow them to apply late if they had reasonable grounds for doing so, and that's to be interpreted quite liberally by Home Office officials. You need to make sure that happens. But then you've also got the longer term problem of all those people who you've only granted this thing called pre-settled status to, who you're saying have to upgrade when they've been here for 5 years. So they've met that 5-year test. And so that's a sort of rolling set of individual deadlines that are about to hit you as well. Remember, behind every person who thinks that they had a right to stay here and who for some reason the Home Office says, no, you don't, there is a very hard case. And that potentially, as we saw with Windrush, can come back to bite you as Home Secretary.
So what is the worst possible situation for me? Is it a series of Windrush type occasions?
I think it is. I think it's lots of people who, to an objective observer, look as though they clearly had lived in the UK for a really long time, but for some reason have had a problem with the process and the system says no, and then they turn up and they find that their rights are denied to them. Worse still, that someone moves into immigration enforcement and you risk having really bad stories about people being removed from the country or denied return to the country because they've failed what looks to everybody else to be just a set of bureaucratic hurdles and absolutely fly in the face of common sense, because to an objective observer, they clearly meet all the criteria.
So that's one kind of bad outcome. Now, if I don't have that outcome, is there a danger that I might be criticised because people essentially are staying on in the country forever and ever without fully managing their status to get settled?
So I think the real risk for you as the Home Secretary's prided herself on your triumph in taking back control of our borders, introduced a new migration regime, is that it looks as though you're presiding over a system that's opening up a sort of backdoor route to entry of people who we thought couldn't enter anymore. You then expose yourself to a sort of scandal that actually there are people who don't meet the criteria and actually don't have these rights, but you're just granting them to them sort of, you know, willy-nilly because you're so keen to avoid these hard cases that you become a very soft touch. And if you're a Conservative Home Secretary, like Priti Patel, you don't want to appear to be a soft touch.
Which of those two worst outcomes is the worst one?
I think the first one is much harder. Every time you see an elderly person in a care home, if they come up and somebody says, have you got settled status? You need that to get your NHS service that you've always depended on. You can see that you moved here in the 1960s. You've always lived here. nobody advised you to apply. I think you just don't want those sorts of stories getting anywhere near the paper, and you don't want somebody down the Home Office food chain at the front line saying no in those circumstances.
So what can I do to ensure that someone down that food chain, or all the people down the food chain, are not taking that kind of decision, but are taking, if you like, the more liberal decision?
I think we need to be absolutely clear that any decision to refuse status is reviewed by someone more senior if there's any reason at all to be worried about it, so that we can make sure that we don't default back to what we've seen with the Home Office before, that the easier thing is to say no. Again, the Home Office made a lot when it introduced this scheme of a presumption to grant status, and it recognised that that was a really big culture change for people in the Home Office, and it just needs to carry that through. The real problem is that will be front of mind for the next few months, maybe even for the next few years. We have people going through pre-settled status into settled status, but we really need that institutional memory carries on and carries on. So it may not be Priti Patel's problem. We change Home Secretaries quite often, with the exception of Theresa May. It may be her successors down the line who face problems. We need to make sure that people in the Home Office pass the baton on to their successors of saying there are these people. And that was one of the things we saw with Windrush, that the baton was really, really badly dropped somewhere between the early 1970s and the late 2000s, 2010s.
Are you saying that instead of the hostile environment, the famous phrase which applied to policy in the past, I should be suggesting nice sunny environment?
Yes, I think we need to be saying that actually we are, for the next few years, going to make sure that your sort of point of contact, the thing isn't you haven't got settled status, so you're not getting this. It's, oh, you don't seem to have got settled status or pre-settled status. You better get on with applying here, and actually they'll be quite accommodating about the grounds you might have had not for applying. So we need to see those points of contact with public services not as a point of enforcement, but actually as a point of encouragement. And I think the Home Office then needs to be thinking, and needs to be thinking now, what does it do about all those people who are going to have to convert for pre-settled status into settled status? How can it make that process as easy for them as possible? If it's clear that they're still in the UK, they're still paying taxes or whatever, the Home Office could think about just upgrading for them. Yeah, I think there's a suggestion that they could just take proof you're still living in the UK, as sufficient proof of 5 years continuous residence. The easier we can make it for people who, any normal observer, as I'd say, would say they look like the sort of person who actually has those rights. Letting a few people who might have just fallen the wrong side of the line through is much less bad for the government than turning down what looked like very well qualified people who, after all, Vote Leave said in the referendum campaign they didn't want to take away anyone's rights. They wanted those people who'd contributed to the UK over the years to stay and continue to contribute. So I think this is a time to be really generous in spirit.
Jill Rutter. So to conclude, the more what seems to be a relatively successful scheme so far is interpreted in a spirit of Zen, the fewer problems we seem likely to encounter. My thanks to Jill Rutter, Mark Easton, Michaela Benson and Catherine Barnard. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirsty Knight and Ben Carter. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. We've explored all kinds of topics, including the world of ransomware, global supply chains, Hamas and the threats to peace in Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm Matthew Side, and I'd like to invite you to see the world differently with my podcast, Sideways.
Those societies and social networks begin to act as a brain, a collective brain unto itself.
Sideways is all about the ideas that shape our lives. And in this series, I'll get to grips with the myth of mind control.
This is your subliminal programming tape on smoking control.
He's what I would consider to be a quack, a charlatan.
And I'll find out why it's so hard to be original. For all this and more, subscribe to Sideways on BBC Sounds.